Hi, I'm Scott Jagow. Working as an office temp isn't for everyone. Some people make a career out of it, but they're like secret agents specializing in detachment.
Go in, fit in, do the job, and get out. It seems really simple, but most people can't do that for some reason.
For people facing foreclosure, getting a roommate might be just the thing.
If they have a home and they have an empty room in their home, why not put that room to good use?
Yeah, but you could wind up being Mr. Roper on Three's Company, the dreaded landlord.
The challenge is you've got an apartment-type setting inside of a single-family home.
Those stories and more coming up as we cover the fallout from the financial crisis. It's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The economy is crumbling faster than we thought. This week, we saw the worst retail sales numbers in four decades and the highest unemployment rate in 14 years. So what do? Hide out in the basement and wait it out? No, but this is a time to save, a time to be cautious, and a time to listen to this program. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Viglin. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
In just about every election, taxes are a crucial separator for the candidates, and this year was no different. John McCain had a very Republican-type philosophy. Small tax breaks for lower incomes, big cuts for the wealthy. Barack Obama's plan was clearly based on his party's ideals. Fairly generous cuts for the lower brackets, steep tax increases for the wealthiest Americans. Now we know who's headed to the White House, so let's take a closer look at Obama's plan. We're joined by our Washington Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale. John, who will benefit the most from Obama's tax proposals?
Well, you know, during the campaign, he did promise, famously, help for the middle class, since he argued that wages haven't been keeping up with inflation. So he's promising lower income taxes for 95% of Americans, people earning less than $250,000 a year. You know, at his speeches, he'd go around and ask for a show of hands, who makes less than $250,000 a year? And of course, that would be most people. And he would say, well, you get a tax cut. And they're pretty substantial cuts, too. The Tax Policy Center finds that the average tax break for households making $118,000 a year or less would be about $900 a year.
All right. Now, who's getting the bite?
Well, to pay for these tax cuts and some of the other ambitious programs under the Obama plan, like health care reform, he's proposing to raise taxes on the wealthy, and not just a little bit. The average increase for people who make $9 million a year or more comes to $800,000 a year. But some of that is just a reversal of the tax cuts that President Bush got through early in his term.
Right. Well, $9 million, I think most people would agree, is wealthy. But the line is drawn at $250,000 for a family. That's where the tax increase would start.
Which a lot of small businesses complain isn't necessarily wealthy. Joe the plumber was the most famous for that. And he got Obama to say that, yeah, he is trying to spread the wealth around. He thinks that's better for the middle class.
You mentioned businesses. What other changes are in store for businesses under the Obama administration?
Well, he would keep the current tax structure, although there is an increase in capital gains taxes above $250,000 from 15 to 20%. And he creates a tax credit for each new job that a business creates.
And what about retirees? What is his approach with older people?
He would waive some of the fees and the penalties for early withdrawal from retirement plans, although that is only temporary. That's part of an effort to kickstart the economy.
So we're talking about 401ks and all that.
That's right.
So they wouldn't pay the 10% penalty, but they still would have to pay the taxes on the money that they take out.
Exactly.
There's been a lot of talk about a second stimulus package. Obviously, Obama has a tax plan that he wants to go with. But what about using tax credits, tax breaks to stimulate the economy? Anything like that coming?
Not really. That's kind of discredited these days. It was tried earlier this year under President Bush's stimulus plan. But right now, you know, with consumers so frightened about the future and less likely to spend any money they get from the government, they might just save it, and that wouldn't stimulate the economy. So most think that it's better to invest in bridges and highways and school buildings that would create jobs and give people more confidence to spend if they get those jobs.
John Dimsdale in Washington, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
240,000 American jobs gone last month. The unemployment rate is now 6.5%. Some people might have to think about temporary work. Yeah, I know it can be thankless and ego-crushing, but temping isn't all about repetitive motion and filing anymore. You can temp in a lot of different fields, and some people actually make a career out of it. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Temps don't always get the respect they like. Sometimes new office mates can't even seem to pin down your name. Here's a clip from online series The Temp Life.
And there will be those temp assignments where you're referred to more as a noun than a person, like being called the temp, or that guy, or she.
Sofia Saraicescu lives in Southern California. She's been temping for 20 years. She's had her share of impersonal treatment, but she loves temping nonetheless, mainly for its variety. Saraicescu, has worked everywhere from the offices of Fortune 500 companies to local stables. Since August, she's been taking time off to help her mother recover from a car accident, and she's not worried about picking up another job. She says employers may lay off full-time staff,
but they still need to get certain jobs done. They still have commitments out there and deadlines, and without the full staff they used to rely on, they are calling temp companies and asking them to send people.
Linda James can back that up. She runs Quality Personnel, an employment agency in McKinney, Texas, just north of Dallas. She says more employers than usual are asking for temps right now.
They're more reticent in general than they were before the downturn in the economy to call me and place an order for a permanent person because they just are not sure how this economy is going to go.
According to the American Staffing Association, temp work usually declines during a bad economy. Steve Burcham is the association's vice president. He says in the last recession, temporary jobs dropped by a third. He says typically the number of jobs grows as the year goes on.
It's usually at its lowest point in January and tends to peak in late November, early December.
2008, he says, is proving an exception.
This year, staffing employment held steady from January up until about the 4th of July. And again, normally we would have seen growth in that period. We didn't, but at the same time, we weren't losing jobs.
On the other hand, Linda James of Quality Personnel has 20 to 30% more temps on her books than she did 6 months ago. She says some have been laid off, and more let their anxiety show.
It's in their mindset, it's in their mannerism, it's in their eyes, and that's part of what I counsel an applicant before they go on an interview, to make sure they guard against that.
It turns out desperation for work is like desperation for love. It turns the other person off. James says many temp positions turn into permanent jobs, so it's important to take them seriously, to dress and act professionally, and to express interest in the position. Career temp Sofia Saraicescu has another tip for anyone turning to temping as an interim measure. She says no matter how important you were in your last job, it's time to squash your ego.
A temp just has to go in, fit in, do the job, and get out and not make any waves. It seems really simple, but most people can't do that for some reason. They want to put their stamp on everything.
Mark Benziger is one of the growing band of temporary workers who's highly educated and highly paid. He works in IT security in Portland. He says despite the downturn, his services are still in demand, but he feels his negotiating position has weakened.
I personally feel like I have less leverage now than I did. You know, 6 months ago or even 12 months ago, when someone would offer me less than what I felt comfortable with, I could have said, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. I think I'd have a harder time doing that right now.
Benziger says he loves being a contractor. He works a set number of hours and no longer feels he has to pour his soul into a company. He's spending more time with his wife and son. But as the economic horizon darkens, he's keeping an eye out for a permanent job. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So we talked about what our taxes might look like under President Obama. Now we're going to dive into some other stuff and get the straight story from our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Chris, with the economy the way it is and a new administration coming in, how should people approach their household budgets?
Yeah, I want to give a note of caution because this is a historic period. But when it comes to your personal finances, the economy is sinking into recession. Layoffs are going to increase. So you want to be very conservative with your personal finances. You know, again, the standard, pay down the debt, tighten your belt. Now, I want to add something else, though. You're going to get these exhortations that, no, you should be spending. You got to help the economy out. No, don't do that. You don't have responsibility to help the economy out. Your responsibility is to protect your household.
True, but Chris, consumer spending is 2/3 of the economy, so the economy isn't going to come out of any kind of funk without consumer spending.
You're right. However, we all know, what's the story of the past decade, Scott? People took on too much debt. So we're going to recommend that people take on more debt. Guess what? They're going to end up in trouble. That's the wrong advice to give. Now, who's going to spend? That's what we learned during the Great Depression. The government, the taxpayer, they're going to spend. And it's going to go into infrastructure, or it may go into rebates. I don't know what programs are going to be out there. I think infrastructure spending is going to be a big part of it.
But doesn't that sound like a dangerous thing to do in this particular time? Pile on more government spending, increasing the deficit when it's already so big from the war in Iraq and now from these bailout programs?
Those are important issues, and we're going to have to deal with it. But it might be a year from now, might be 2 years from now. I'm not saying fiscal discipline isn't important. But what you want to be in a situation, and this is what we hopefully move toward, is when times are good, we will reduce the deficit. When times are bad, you don't worry about the deficit. There's a good chance in the next couple of years, the fiscal budget deficit gets to $1 trillion. This is terrible. But not right now. Not when the economy is spinning lower. Not when the consumer is doing the sensible thing and spending less in borrowing less. So the government needs to offset it. It's the lesson of every recession we've gone through. This time is no different.
So you're saying individuals and households should be frugal, but the philosophy for the government should be to build up more debt?
Yes.
All right. Maybe the emails will start pouring in now. Chris Farrell.
I'm sure they're coming.
Chris, we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
The day after the election, some small business people started moving their money around. Others are sticking to their game plan and crossing their fingers.
I can't say that my plans have been changed by Obama, only my hope that he can get us out of this difficult time more quickly.
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Vigeland. We put a call out looking for small business people to tell us what they're thinking with a recession coming on and a new administration coming in. A lot of people responded, and now we're going to hear from two of them. Jeff lives in Irving, Texas. He's a consultant to Hotels.com. He voted for McCain. We're also joined by Raul in Palo Alto, California. He's trying to launch his own internet company, and he voted for Obama. Raul, I'll begin with you. You're starting a business in this economy? What, are you crazy?
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. sometimes, you know, situations happen where you had made plans and you have to move forward with them. But on the other hand, a startup is a good company to create during a recession because you have to develop a product. And if you can develop it during the 12 to 18 months that you're in the bad period, hopefully as your product comes out and you begin to sell it, then you're coming out of the recession into a growth market, and then to have a product when customers are ready to buy again.
All right, that's I can buy that. That's a good philosophy, Raul. Now, Jeff from Irving, Texas is also with us. Jeff, you didn't get what you wanted. You voted for McCain.
I did.
So now what for you? Is there anything that you're going to do differently now that you know that Obama will be in the White House?
Yeah, I think the major thing differently is there's so many different stories in terms of what's going to happen tax-wise and who's going to be, you know, see their taxes increased. My wife and I have spoken about limiting after-tax outside investments and instead keeping almost, all, you know, as much as we can in 401k, IRA, tax advantage type pieces that help also decrease your taxable income level.
So you're going to play pretty conservative, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, especially for the next couple of years.
Now, Raul, what about you? Are you going to do anything specific beyond obviously starting your company here to either take advantage of the fact that Obama is in the White House and the Democrats rule Congress, or as a preventative measure against whatever policies might be coming?
I actually agree quite strongly with Jeff that the prudent thing to do in a very difficult economic situation, regardless of who's in power, is to be very conservative with your investments and to be very careful how you spend money. To be honest, I can't really say that my plans have been changed that way by Obama, only my hope that he can get us out of this difficult time more quickly.
Now, let me ask you both about the T word, taxes. In your email, Raul, you were saying you would support higher taxes rather than continue with government borrowing against the future, which means the future for your kids, right?
I very much agree with that. One of the things that I find extremely distressing at this time is the amount of borrowing that's going on for the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan that my children and perhaps their children are going to have to pay for. And it doesn't seem fair. So to that extent, I believe that one has to pay one's way. I don't like higher taxes. I don't want to pay more taxes. But I do believe that you have to be responsible for the environment that you live in.
All right, Jeff, what's your view on the tax situation?
Well, I mean, to me, I think, you know, the tax rates, you know, in some cases, I think our taxes are still too high. We pay the highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world, but then here or there, Congress exempts certain, you know, special interest groups or special industries from those taxes. A smarter, lower tax rate that would actually increase revenue but get rid of all the loopholes would serve our country better in terms of, especially with us trying to get out of a economic downturn. I think personal taxes are the same way. There's so many different ways that, you know, with a good accountant or a good lawyer, you can avoid paying your fair share, that it's not so much the tax rate, it's the means we use to collect it.
The system,
yes.
the way it works or doesn't work. All right, here's your chance to look into the future. Give me your crystal ball, Raul, for the next couple of years.
I believe that the next 12 to 18 months are going to be a very difficult economic period. Towards the end of 2009, I believe that we'll start to see the economy bouncing back and really starting a new growth period.
Jeff, how about you? What's your vision of the future here?
Well, the long-term vision is good, but I would agree that in the short term, particularly in the next 12 to 18 months, are going to be very difficult. I think a lot of it is investor psychology more than anything else. Probably at 18 months, you know, we'll at least have a good idea on where the national debt through all these stimulus is going to end up. And hopefully with some closer to living within our means on a government basis, you know, that'll help turn the tide on that.
Jeff from Irving, Texas, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thanks.
And Raul from Palo Alto, California, thanks for being on and good luck with your business.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriveand.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
On all the Marketplace programs, we've been asking a simple question. What are you doing? What are you doing with your money in this economy? Today, we're going to hear from Chris Gardner. You might know his story. He went from living on the streets with his son to running an investment firm. Actor Will Smith played him in the movie The Pursuit of Happiness. The real-life Chris Gardner lives and works in Chicago. We caught up with him by phone and asked him what he's doing.
I won't say that I've been doing anything differently. I missed big run-ups in the stock market. I missed big run-ups in real estate because I was concerned that levels were just too high. And the truth of the matter is, now that it turns out, I missed some of the upside, but I missed all of the downside. I'm not smart. I got lucky. I talked to a lot of people around the country, and I was hearing people say that, well, we're concerned. No matter how high the stock market marched, a lot of people were saying, I'm afraid, I am not certain, I'm not sure. That encouraged me to continue my path, which was do nothing but stack up cash. Cash is key. I saw a survey in a paper, can't remember where, but the survey says that 41% of people in America consider themselves to be part of the have-nots, not the haves. Who would have ever thought? Do I think we'll be able to get out of this thing? Yes, we will. We've gotten out of previous situations, though we've never seen anything quite like this. And all of these smart guys that you see on television telling you what the market is going to do, what the Fed should do, nobody knows. My tips for, or suggestions to, anyone in this environment right now, which is all of us, let's get rid of all the debt that we can. Let's think long term. Keep it tight.
Chris Gardner, keeping it tight, for Here's What I'm Doing. Just one piece of Marketplace's coverage of the financial crisis fallout. You can find more voices from our series at marketplace.org. Time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we take your questions. And here to dish out more insight and advice is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. What's up, Chris?
Well, Scott, I'm ready to dish out some advice. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, you dish out a lot of stuff. All right, we're going to start this round with David in Richfield, Minnesota. And his question is about morale in the workplace during tough economic times like these. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Now, what is your situation? Where do you work?
Well, I work at Best Buy. I work for Accenture, which manages Best Buy's IT department. You know, we've got just a kind of a general feeling of things are tough right now.
And your question about morale for Chris, what is it?
I would like to help give the employees what reassurance we can, give them some coping information, give them some resources to reach out to try and get through this.
Besides listening to this show? No, I think it's a wonderful question. And I have a couple of thoughts. One is I think brown bags are great. One reason why I do like the notion of a brown bag lunch is you can gather a lot of material for people. For example, a while back, I did what I think are the 10 best investment books in times of trouble. So you can gather that on the internet.
In fact, I've found lots of actually pretty helpful articles, like quick tips on avoiding debt when money is tight.
But the nice thing about having people come in and talk to them and share their expertise, even in the internet age, that sort of person-to-person conversation matters. You know, bringing in an economic historian or a financial historian where people can come and ask their questions and it's a safe zone. And if they want to bring their spouses or their partners or their friends or their children and to be welcoming that way.
Now, Chris, beyond just talking about this, are there any other things that David can do as a manager to increase morale? Just little things that might keep people confident about their situation?
There's two things. These sound like cliches, but listen to employees, listen to your team members, and be frank with them. If they're asking a lot of questions that you can't answer that are internal to the company, then you're the liaison that goes to human resources and says, we need a manager who can come down here to really address the employee issues. Because the only thing that really seems to work over any period of time is to communicate and to have an open door policy. So that's another thing that you can do, is both be an open line of communication yourself, but also when you're recognizing that there's some issue that's arising, that you are then the advocate for your team members in order to get an answer from elsewhere in the company.
Obviously, the bottom line here is communication in this kind of environment.
We think so, and that's why I reached out, looking for just continuing that dialogue and better ways to communicate and what the message should look like.
All right, David, thanks so much for your email, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I love the show.
Next, we have a question about microfinance. Eric in Denver doesn't have a whole lot of faith in big corporations or the big banks at this point, so he's looking for another way to invest, something a little more trustworthy, and he's asking about microfinance. He writes us, microfinance is succeeding because loans are transparent. Lenders know the borrowers. Borrowers are not encouraged to take out more debt than they need, and loans aren't run through a Vegematic that slices and dices the loans beyond recognition. Very nice analogy there. So, Chris, he wants to know if microfinance really is that rosy, or is it too good to be true?
No, microfinance is good. And just to define microfinance, these are very, very tiny loans that are made to the poorest people, whether it's here in the United States or particularly in Asia, Africa, Latin America. The default rate is very small. And this is one of the more exciting trends in finance today and in charitable giving. By and large, the microfinance world was really funded by foundations, the very wealthy people, the Bill Gates of the world. And the trend has been in recent years to make it more and more available for middle-class folk through their charitable giving to participate in the microfinance revolution around the world.
Now, one that he mentioned was the Schwab Charitable Fund, which has just been launched recently. How does that one work, and how is it different from previous microfinance funds?
A lot of financial institutions, TIA, CREF, Vanguard, Schwab, they set up what are called donor advised funds. You'll put your money in there, and it can be invested in a number of things, typically mutual funds. So we're talking about your donor advised fund. That's the money in that fund that you have with Schwab. And what they've come up with is a very innovative program. Let's say you have $5,000, and that's what you fund your donor advised fund with, right? So $5,000. Then what you can do is take 10% of that. So that's what? $500. You can take 10% of that, because that's the limit, and you're going to be the guarantor, right? You're going to guarantee microfinance loans if they go bad. So that's an encouragement for somebody else to lend them out, right? So really, it's a way of trying to not only encourage microfinance loans, but you get to do a little bit of double duty with your charitable fund.
Well, if the banks won't lend to each other, the people will do it.
The people will do it. And, you know, it's one of the real puzzles, Scott, and it's something I think more and more people need to think about, which is why was the default rate so horrendously high with subprime loans and the default rate is so low with microfinance loans?
Something to think about. All right, Chris, thank you.
Okay.
That's all the time we have right now for questions, but you can call and leave a message with your question for Chris at any time. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or you can reach us by email. Find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. We'll be back with more Getting Personal later on in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Earlier, we heard from Chris Gardner about what he's doing with his money. He's the CEO of an investment firm, which is extraordinary because he used to have no money. He lived on the street. There are plenty of Americans who still do, and they struggle every day just to eat. On this week's Day in the Work Life, we turn the spotlight on a woman who helps people find their next meal.
My name is Amy Gressett. I'm a food stamp advocate. Some of the issues that I deal with on a regular basis are people wanting to apply for food stamps. We also have food pantries in the area that I give them a list of those food pantries. And I coordinate all the volunteers. My work has, as a food stamp advocate, has recently doubled. What I'm seeing mostly these days are people that have never had to apply for food stamps before. I'm seeing people for the first time that are really at their wit's end about how they can get help and assistance to make their life easier. And I remember this one instance where a woman came in and she had 5 children, and she was very desperate, came to me for food stamps. I didn't hear much from her after that. And about a month later, she came in to tell me that she had received her food stamps, and it was the healthiest her children had eaten. I recently had an elderly woman who came in to apply for food stamps with her daughter, and she was going to be turning 90, had worked her whole life, was making the decision on whether or not to buy food or medication, and that really got to me. I think what makes me good at my job is that I've been there. I was homeless. I received food stamps. I've received lots of help from different agencies and programs throughout the country. So people appreciate that I share with them my struggles and my story, and it makes them feel more comfortable coming to me and asking for help. I make $12.79 an hour, which I consider a good amount of money. Honestly, this is not a job that I'm going to make millions of dollars at. But what is more important to me is the people that I'm reaching. It can drain you, but I know that I'm helping. So I just try to do the work that I'm doing. And when I get home, I just try to sit and relax and forget about the day. It's hard to come and ask for help. It takes a lot for you to do that. And I know every time somebody walks through that door, it's because they really need the help. And I'm going to try anything I can to help them.
That's Amy Gressett, a food stamp advocate from Worcester, Massachusetts. To find out more about her, check out our website, marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Judith Ritter. The generation that lived through the Great Depression is still utterly devoted to saving in every way.
You used to tell us to close the refrigerator because the milk would spoil.
I still do. I didn't say it today after lunch because I was being very polite.
One New Jersey grandma slams the door on waste. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Vigeland. Got a joke for you. A young actor is trying to convince his landlord to wait on the rent. He says, "In a few years, I'll be famous, and people will say, Tom Smith used to live in that apartment." And the landlord says, "If I don't get the rent tonight, Tom, they can say it tomorrow." Being a landlord probably isn't much fun, but some people facing foreclosure have to consider becoming one. From KXJZ in Sacramento, Marianne Russ reports.
A lot of people in Kristen Barone's position might just give up. She and her husband, Ephraim, paid $400,000 for their 4-bedroom, 3-bath home a year and a half ago. Now it's worth maybe $300,000. It's in a Sacramento area neighborhood where foreclosure signs are about as common as mailboxes. The Barone's landscaping business went south with the housing market. Kristen says she's been late on the $2,100 mortgage payment for 5 months straight.
I'm afraid of that roller coaster. I don't want to get behind. I don't want to, you know, miss my bills. So, I mean, I made a list of things I could do to bring in more income. And one of them was renting out the room.
She put an ad on Craigslist for 2 of the 4 bedrooms. At first, no hits. Then she lowered the rent from $525 to $400. A woman in her 60s is taking one. The other still up for grabs.
Yeah, this is the master bedroom. office, nursery.
The Barone's 1,900-square-foot home is already pretty full. There's Kristen, her husband, 5-year-old Allie, 5-month-old EJ, and Ephraim's mother, Ernestina. They're giving up the office and Allie's playroom to make space for new housemates. Kristen says she knows it'll be a challenge.
I hope that, you know, it works out because I, you know, myself, you know, we're just hard workers. We know whatever it takes, we're just going to have to push to, you know, make ends meet. If this is the first step of many things we have to do to keep the house, we'll try our best to do it.
If they have a home and they have an empty room in their home, why not put that room to good use?
Laura Fanucchi is based in San Mateo, California. She's on the board of the National Shared Housing Resource Center. It's a sort of clearinghouse for groups that match homeowners with renters. She says it's tough to track, but organizations across the country are taking more calls from people looking to find housemates.
Whenever I talk to somebody either back east or in the Midwest, I mean, we pretty much have the same kinds of issues throughout the country where people can't afford their housing, whether they're someone who, you know, is seeking housing, or if they have a home, you know, they really are looking for somebody who can help share those costs and share those utility costs as well.
And she says it can be a good deal for both the owner and the renter, but there are risks. Corey Kaler is with the Rental Housing Association of Sacramento.
The challenge is you've got an apartment type setting inside of a single family home.
He says there are several potential pitfalls. For example, homeowners insurance typically won't cover a renter's belongings, or there could be local codes restricting the number of cars in a driveway. And he says homeowners are still required to follow fair housing guidelines when screening potential housemates.
If they screen wrong and they get a fair housing complaint, perhaps they get the wrong person in there who vandalizes the place, or the homeowner does need to contact an attorney and spends money to try and get the person out of there. You know, they need to consider that and make sure that they at least try and do the homework before they decide to dive into this idea.
This isn't the first time Americans have had to dive into the room rental business. Eric Rauschway is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. He says just as families across the country are feeling forced into renting a room today, families during the Great Depression had to do likewise to make ends meet.
All these people would have felt like, I thought we were over this phase in our family's existence. And they would have felt that, you know, we're being forced back into a previous stage of the way people had to live. And I'm quite sure that a lot of people who are taking in lodgers feel very similar now.
Rauschway says taking in a housemate has historically been a temporary, not a long-term, way to stay afloat. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ from Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. By Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
We're back with more Getting Personal. Economist and personal finance expert Chris Farrell is with us once again, and we're ready for a few more questions. Are you ready, Chris?
Oh, yes, I am.
All right. So we've been getting a ton of emails about 529 accounts. Lots of people are thinking of how they can save up for college these days. So first, we'll start with Lila in Milwaukee, who wants to know if 529s vary by state.
Yes, they do. So there's, you know, the certain rules are the same across the states, but the investment options can be different, fees can differ, and that's why you need to do research before you just plunk your money into a 529 plan.
And what about FDIC protection? Is that across the board, or is it vary state to state?
Scott, did you ever think you'd be talking about the FDIC this much?
I know.
It comes up all the time. And here's my fearless forecast. I'm going out on a limb here that over the next year, there are going to be a lot more FDIC options in 529 plans. Right now, there are only a couple. For example, Ohio, Arizona, and Montana, they have their own little program. But basically, if you look at all the 529 options, they all have some very conservative choices, and you can look at the particular fund and see what it's made up of. So they're not FDIC insured, but they're very conservative. They'll preserve the value of your principal. Of course, you're not going to get a very high return. They're interested in the safety of principal.
Okay, I said we had a flurry of emails, and I wasn't joking. Let's move on to the next one. Brad in Pasadena, Maryland, wants to know, what happens if you choose a state account and then the person the account is for moves to another state?
It doesn't matter. States matter when you're looking at the 529 plan because they differ, as I said earlier. But you can use the money in any state.
Okay, email number three here comes from Alan in Maplewood, New Jersey. He's wondering if you can use a 529 account to pay for a college or university overseas.
Well, it turns out there are about 800 institutions. That's the last count that I have. 800 foreign institutions that can use your 529 plan. So if you go to the Federal Financial Aid website, FAFSA, you can find a link to foreign countries, and then it lists all the institutions that are accredited. If it's an accredited institution, you can tap the 529 plan.
This week, we also heard from Lauren in Seattle. She's trying to help her son pay for college and at the same time preserve something for her retirement. Hi, Lauren. How are you?
I'm good.
So what is your situation? How old is your son?
My son's 19. He's a sophomore in college. I paid for his college the first year. It cost $40,000 for him to go to college. And my financial planner said if I do that, I won't have any money left to retire on. So we took out loans this year, but he's not eligible for any free money. And I'm trying to figure out how to do this without ending up with $100,000 in loans after he graduates from school.
Sounds like a tough situation. What is your question specifically for Chris?
Well, I took out an equity line of credit through a credit union, and it's at 5%, and the loans are at 8 and 8.5%. I would pay off the loans with the equity line of credit and then pay that off.
First of all, I think it's wonderful that you want to help out your son. Clearly, it's a value to you. It's something that you want to do. My job is to put on a slightly cold-hearted financial hat. You're at the twilight of your career. He's at the beginning of his career. He's got lots of time to make money. I'd have him borrow and borrow and borrow to pay for his college education. And then the two of you paying them off over time. Although, again, I'd lean on him because he's at the beginning of his career. What you can do is help him out so that he can explore, he can try different things. But I would not take on the legal obligation of paying off those loans.
Lauren, maybe we should mention to Chris that your son is studying musical theater.
Yeah, he may end up being a singing waiter. And the other thing is he can't get any loans without a co-signer.
Okay. Under that case, then you probably are going to have to do the co-signing in the new world order that we're in. I still don't like it. He's got to take the bigger risk, not you. He's the one that needs to absorb that risk with his eyes open, understanding what are the trade-offs. You're going to backstop him, but you may not be there to help him out as much as he'd like, or that as much as you would like.
So if I'm going to help him, should I be just using the income I have, or what do you think about the equity line of credit?
Well, what I don't like about the equity line of credit, you know, we're going through a tough time with the housing market. We don't know how long this is going to last. I just want to limit, like, putting your home at risk
right
to his college education. That's a bad trade-off to me.
So I shouldn't touch that equity line of credit. I haven't touched it yet. I didn't use it for this year. I took out a loan.
I wouldn't touch it. In this environment, I wouldn't touch it.
Okay. It's hard to be tough, but I think that I need to do that.
Okay, Lauren. Well, good luck to you, and I hope your son lands on Broadway.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much for your help.
All right, take care.
All righty, bye.
And we've run out of time once again for questions, but you can reach us by phone and leave your question any time of day. That number is 877-275-6669. 877-ASK-MONY. You can also drop us a note at marketplace.org. Just look for the Getting Personal link. And Chris has a blog on the site as well. And Chris, you take more questions there, right?
Absolutely, and I love taking those questions.
Thanks, as always, for your great advice.
Well, you're welcome, Scott.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If you're 62 or older and the stock market is eating your retirement, here's something to think about. a reverse mortgage. Instead of making a payment every month, you get paid. It's a loan, it's tax-free, and it's due when the house is sold. The government just made some changes to reverse mortgages, so let's bring in Meg Burns. She's with the Federal Housing Administration. Meg, first, why a reverse mortgage instead of, say, an equity line of credit?
To qualify for a home equity line of credit, a senior has to have some source of income that demonstrates their capacity to repay on that mortgage. And a lot of seniors don't actually have cash flow. They don't have a lot of other assets to tap. And that's the beauty of the reverse mortgage. You don't have to have income to qualify for it.
What do you have to be careful with if you're thinking about doing a reverse mortgage?
Well, there are two factors that at play here. One is that the senior gets hurt in the sense that they tapped into equity for something that maybe they then were disappointed they spent the money on, and there's not additional equity to tap for something else. When the senior dies, the estate is responsible for selling the property, and then those proceeds are used to pay off the reverse mortgage. So it is true that potentially the heirs are affected by an unwise use of or reverse mortgage proceeds as well.
Now, I read that the fees for reverse mortgages can be kind of high and that you have to watch out for that.
Right. This is actually one of those interesting myths. The fees associated with a reverse mortgage are exactly the same as the fees and charges associated with a forward mortgage. The difference between a reverse and forward is that all of the charges are very transparent with a reverse mortgage. As we all know, when you get a forward mortgage, you often have the option to get a no closing cost loan or, you know, no origination fee, but the lender folds that into the interest rate. So there are fees and charges that people don't see that are very obvious to them with reverse mortgages, which is actually a good thing.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. There have been some changes to the policy regarding reverse mortgages. Some of them have to do with consumer protection. I want to focus on the limit for these mortgages. It's been up to $417,000. How does that affect the landscape for reverse mortgages?
It's actually a very good thing for the FHA reverse mortgage product. FHA's loan limits previously varied by geographical area, and they were set based on the median sales price in the area. So in low-cost areas of the country like Alabama, the limits were set in the $200,000 range, and in higher-cost areas like, say, parts of California, they were set at the $360,000 range. So the new single national loan limit makes the product more equitable for seniors living all across the country, that based on the value of their property as opposed to the FHA loan limit, they would be eligible to tap the same amount of proceeds.
Well, you've been very helpful, Meg. Meg Burns from the FHA, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been doing a little series called Revisiting the Depression. Not because we think we're going back to those days, but that generation knows a thing or two about being frugal and about saving. Their grandchildren might roll their eyes when they hear the stories, but that doesn't mean they aren't listening. Reporter Jamie Bedrin sat down with her grandmother in Cedar Grove, New Jersey.
Grandma, when we were little kids, you used to tell us to close the refrigerator because the milk would spoil.
I still do. I didn't say it today after lunch because I was being very polite. My stepmother never let us open the refrigerator for more than 1 second because she said the food's going to spoil. People didn't waste things in those days.
Grandma, can you give me an idea of what life was like during the Great Depression?
Mostly I was affected by the children in school because they didn't have enough to eat. The city set up nutrition classes whereby we prepared food and cooking class and for the children, and we set it out for them, and they had a lunch every day. Otherwise, they would have gone without lunch.
Now, you told me about the bank next door to you, and you said you have a memory of things being sold from the bank. Can you tell me about that?
When the banks failed, they had so much equipment that had to be sold. And so everybody had a chance to go in and buy whatever the bank had, desks, chairs. It was just a terrible thing that the bank failed.
On a lighter note, tell me about the things that you did for fun.
We loved the radio. We loved all the programs, Marv Perkins and the Lone Ranger. And, of course, we had Eddie Cantor at night.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and all you people who have driven up here in this Greyhound bus. Consider yourselves my personal guests.
It's just there are these images from the Depression of people standing in food lines and job lines. Do you remember any of that?
They refer to it as Apple Mary because people would form lines just to get an apple. And this is true. They gave out the town, the city, whatever, did give away free apples.
What's funny? Why are you laughing?
Why am I laughing? Because it really wasn't funny, you know. But looking back, you can sort of smile about it then. I mean, people throw away good apples today. And then people stood online for them.
It was just a different time.
Well, we were different kind of people then, you know. We saved money, we were frugal, and that's the way it was then.
Blanche Bedren of Cedar Grove, New Jersey, revisiting the Depression with her granddaughter, reporter Jamie Bedren. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, for some people, saving money is like learning to drive. Once they start doing it, it becomes second nature. But most people haven't learned how to save.
It's just like a flat tire. You know, nobody really knows exactly where the tire iron is or how it's going to work until you have a flat tire.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Scott Jagow. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.